Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY. This is Community Conversations, which we air Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. in place of our regular morning show. We're featuring pre-recorded interviews on different issues in our community as a stand-in for the morning show until the coronavirus recedes and it's safe to be back in our studio again. And I gotta say, we hope that's pretty soon. I'm Chris Bessler, host for today's show. Today we continue our local decision election coverage for the upcoming May 19th primary election. We have interviews with the two Republican candidates for state representative in District 1, Seat B, Gary Supiger, and the incumbent, Sage Dixon. Again, we want to repeat an important note about this election, which is that due to the coronavirus, there will be no in-person voting for the primary. All voting is being done by absentee ballot. To vote, you must request an absentee ballot be sent to you by mail, and you can do that right now by going to the county elections page at bonnercountyid.gov. The state has a very good website where you can request a ballot at idahovotes.gov, and there's a lot of information about the election and all the candidates at the Election Central on sandpointonline.com. So, be sure to request that absentee ballot. You must do it by May 19th, and it has to be returned by June 2nd. And with that, let's get on to the interviews. First, we speak with the Republican candidate for State Representative Gary Supiger. Our interview is about 24 minutes long and is followed by our second interview with the incumbent Sage Dixon. Gary Supiger, Republican candidate for District 1 State Representative, thank you for talking with us today. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Chris. It's a beautiful day in North Idaho. I'm looking out the window at the lake and the sunshine and the blue sky, and I'm enjoying it.
We live in a beautiful place, that's for sure. Well, let's start out with an introduction for voters who may not be acquainted with you. Tell us about your background and qualifications that you feel would help you in the job of state representative.
Well, thanks, Chris, for giving me the opportunity to speak to your listeners. My name's Gary Supiger. I live in the Kokalala area. I'm a candidate for the House of Representatives from District 1, Position B. The reason I'm running for the representative is because there's some things that I think I need to stand up and be heard. The issues in my campaign are property tax relief. You know, property taxes are rising in this district as well as across the state. They need to be addressed. I'm also passionate about education. And I want to find a formula that gives some security for adequate financing for the public schools around the state. Another issue I'm concerned about is local governance. Every community in the state has a school board, has a city council, has county commissioners, and those elected representatives are in the best position to govern in their areas, and the state needs to let them do that. My experience is I'm a business owner. I've owned a business for 35 years, managed a business. I'm an incumbent school board member in the Lake Pendere School District, and from inside the boardroom in the last 3 years, I've really learned about education and the resources needed to provide for Idaho's most valuable resources, our children.
Okay, well, great. We're going to dig in on some of those issues that you just mentioned there. But first, let's start out with the current situation we find ourselves in, and that's the coronavirus response. Governor Little has suspended his stay-at-home order, and he's kicked off a reopening of the Idaho's economy in four different stages that are successive. We've just entered stage one, which goes through May 15th. It allows more businesses to open but retains some closures on restaurant dining and gyms and hair salons. Those will start to open in stage two so long as the virus caseload keeps declining. The governor's calling this Idaho Rebounds, his plan. What do you think of the governor's plan?
I fully support the governor's plan. I think the governor of Idaho has showed tremendous courage and leadership in addressing the coronavirus situation in our state. We've had the stay-at-home order now for several weeks. I know as a school board member, we dismiss schools, many businesses that are non-essential are not working, shops, restaurants, hotels are closed. You know, I know this is painful for people around the district, but I think it's absolutely necessary. We now have over 60,000 fatalities in the United States from coronavirus. We've exceeded the number of fatalities in the Vietnam War. Coronavirus has been around 2 months. The Vietnam War went on 10 years. So coronavirus is deadly. It's highly contagious. You know, it's stealthy because the carriers many times are asymptomatic. They can be carrying and spreading this disease without even having any symptoms. Therefore, I think the governor's response, the Center for Disease Control's response, the President of the United States' response is entirely appropriate and necessary. I think government's first responsibility is the safety and security of the people. And I support Governor Little's plan to reopen the economy. I think the four-stage plan is very reasonable. You know, we need to show that we've got this under control and that the curve is flattening and the number of cases are going down before we can go back to work, you know, on a progressive scale. So, Chris, yeah, I think the governor's reasonable. I think it's prudent. I think it's necessary. You know, I support the governor.
Okay, quick follow-up on that. Thursday, the governor announced, as part of the Idaho Rebounds Program, grants of up to $300 million for businesses in distress, specifically the ones that missed out on the first federal programs. Do you think that's an appropriate position for the state to be taken?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, I support Governor Little wholeheartedly, and especially, you know, his economic plan. You know, his plan over the last 2 years to expand our economy by reducing regulations and fees and using the state, you know, to support small business instead of fight small business has been, you know, very successful. And now the governor is just taking that one step further. This coronavirus has been devastating, you know, to many small businesses. I know I'm a small businessman. I'm better off than most because my business has been able to operate through the epidemic. But many, many people, you know, aren't so fortunate, you know, especially smaller businesses or, you know, a shop, a restaurant, you know, a hotel, a small insurance company or office businesses, you know, they've had to suspend operations, which is very difficult for their employees, their customers, their vendors. The governor's response to provide assistance to those people is essential, you know, because without small business is the backbone of our community. Without small business, you know, our entire state's economy is going to collapse. And the governor is doing the right thing to help those people who have the greatest need.
Okay, well, let's turn to education, which you identify as one of the biggest issues that you're concerned with. Education is actually the biggest piece of the state's annual budget right now, but Idaho still ranks among the very lowest in the nation in per pupil expenditures by the state. And that fact requires almost all the school districts in the state to run supplemental levies. Do you feel the state is adequately funding our schools?
Chris, education is the most important thing the state does to prepare, you know, our young people, you know, for their career and their lives is the most important thing that we do. Idaho, unfortunately, puts a very, very low priority on public education. We're not near the bottom. We're at the bottom. According to the National Education Association, Idaho ranks 51st in the nation. That's all the states and District of Columbia in what we spend per student for our K-12 education program. So we need to find more resources to support our schools, to support our students, so that they have the tools to succeed in life. Now, the education formula from the state is not only inadequate, it's amplified by its inequitable. Every school district in the legislature puts a huge burden on every school district in the state to find the resources that are not provided by the state to operate their school system. The only tool the legislature gives the local school districts is the property tax. Property taxes are inherently inequitable. Every school district has a different situation. They have a different assessed valuation within their district. They have a different enrollment. They have a different popular support for their levies. So levies can vary from zero to over 100% of the what the state provides for education. Like, take for instance Preston, Idaho, and several other small districts. They've been unable to pass levies. They don't have the popular support. They're trying to educate their children on the monies that the state provides them, which isn't adequate, and they're just going backwards. And then on the other end of the spectrum is Blaine County. Blaine County, they have a very, very high assessed valuation. They can raise significant amounts of money, and they've done that. They have a levy in place there that's providing over $10,000 per student per year for K-12 education. So I think we need to level the playing field. I don't think it's fair that a student in Blaine County is getting what the state provides, which is around $6,500, plus, you know, over $10,000 that the community is providing for their education, whereas a student on in another corner of the state over in Preston, an agricultural area that's poor, only gets the $6,500. I think every student in Idaho is important, and every student deserves an equal chance to succeed with education. Therefore, we need to come up with a funding formula that provides equitable resources, you know, for students in every district across the state.
And what would your suggestion for that be?
My suggestion for that would be to go back and look at what we did before 2006. In 2006, the legislature changed the funding formula in Idaho. They substituted a statewide property tax support for a 1% sales tax. At that time, the then Governor Risch and the economists at the State Department felt that a 1% increase in sales tax would provide the resources necessary to continue to fund education. Prior to 2006, the state funded virtually all of education in the state on an equitable formula. In 2006, they eliminated property tax support at the state level for education. They instituted this 1% sales tax. It was failure from the very beginning. Sales tax receipts never met the expectations, and the problem was accelerated by the recession the state had from 2008 to 2010, where state receipts actually decreased. So what happened was the number of districts that needed supplemental levy support increased from about a quarter of the districts in the state that were seeking, you know, 2, 3, 5% of their budgets from their local taxpayers through levies, to 3/4 of the districts in the state that are funding a third or 40% of their budgets with supplemental levies. So bearing 40% of a district's budget on the shoulders of the local property tax owners is a huge burden for those property tax owners and unfair to the students and the other districts around the state. We need to reverse this formula. We need to take the property tax levies for schools out of your local tax bill and bear that the way it historically was from the state. The state can provide the resources to provide an equitable education around the state without the bearing it on the shoulders of the local property tax owners.
Okay, well, thanks for that answer. Let's squeeze in one more, a quick one here on the tax question. Lawmakers have been debating for years whether to remove Idaho's 6% sales tax on groceries. It came up again this year's session, but it was left unresolved. Are you a yay or a nay on taxing groceries?
I'm a nay. Clearly, I'm a nay. You know, groceries are essential, and grocery taxes are regressive. There's no grocery taxes in our surrounding states. There's no grocery tax in Montana. There's no grocery tax in Oregon. There's no grocery tax in Washington. Many Idahoans that live near the border are crossing the state line to go shop, you know, in other states to get their groceries. I think Idaho stores are losing business. I think Idaho families are paying an unfair tax by paying a tax on groceries. And I think Idaho grocery buyers are inconvenienced by having to travel out of state to buy their groceries. So I think the logical thing to do is to just eliminate sales taxes on groceries.
Okay. Let's move on to a couple other issues. One that was a hot button issue actually last year, not this year, was some proposed bills to restrict the citizen initiative process. There was a push in the 2019 legislature to make that process quite a bit more restrictive. It didn't come up in the 2020 legislature, but may in the future. What do you think about the initiative process as it currently stands, and should it be more restrictive?
Chris, I enthusiastically support the initiative process. Idaho is fortunate that it's one of the majority of the states in the country that has two forms of democracy. We have the representative democracy, where we elect representatives to the state house to represent us. But we also have what's called a direct democracy, which means that citizens can get an initiative on a statewide ballot to change state policy. It's difficult. You have to raise a significant amount of signatures to get these initiatives on the ballots. But we've had this process since the framers of our Constitution inserted it into the Constitution in 1910. So it's a process that's over 110 years old. It's served our state very, very well through the years. Some very important things have been enacted through the initiative process. The Fish and Game Commission was created through the initiative process. Dredge mining in our streams and rivers was controlled through the initiative process. Candidates like myself for state office and for local office, you know, now have to disclose the contributors to their campaign because the initiative process. Lobbyists that lobby our legislators have to register through the initiative process. And the latest thing we did through the initiative process was we expanded health care through Medicaid expansion in 2016. And this has now been in effect for 2 years. Over 70,000 Idahoans, you know, now have health care because of the initiative process. My opponent, you know, has vastly different views on this. He introduced the legislation to try to restrict the initiative process. He wanted to make it handcuff the process by making it much more difficult to pass initiatives by requiring more signatures, by requiring more districts to provide signatures, and confining the time to raise signatures. You know, his legislation was vetoed by the governor, and then after it was vetoed by the governor, he reintroduced it 3 days later. When the governor vetoed it on a Friday, the following Monday, he came back and reintroduced it in four pieces. So he has been an advocate for eliminating or handcuffing the legislative process. I think it's part of our democracy. It's been with us for 110 years. It's served us well. I don't see any reason why we can't continue to use it.
Okay. You mentioned a bill that was actually passed through the initiative process, and that was the Medicaid expansion. That came up again in the 2020 session. Because they were dealing with the funding, the state's funding portion of that. They ended up leaving the session with it's still not completely funded, and the state legislature may need to deal with that again in the 2021 session. Any thoughts on the Medicaid expansion? And we are getting close to time here, so...
Well, I support Medicaid expansion. It's a great program, you know, for people that aren't familiar with it. It fills the gap between people that qualify for Medicaid and people that can purchase health care on the exchange. Now, I'm not a supporter of government-controlled health care, but until we have... you know, a private program that's comparable to this, I think it's the best option we have. Medicaid expansion is funded 90% by the federal government. Federal government provides 90% of the funding for it. The state is required to match those funds with 10%. Okay, we're now in our second year of Medicaid expansion in Idaho. The first year, we paid for it entirely out of monies the state had in a reserve account for health care through the tobacco settlement. Okay, in the second year of Medicaid expansion, we funded it mostly, I think about three-quarters of the funds came from that same tobacco settlement fund, but a portion of the funds came from monies that were reserved for indigent health care. You know, indigent health care became almost a moot issue when Medicare expansion was passed because indigents now could get health care through Medicaid expansion and didn't have to be supported by local counties and the state. So Medicaid expansion was funded for the last 2 years, you know, through monies that were already reserved for health care. Now, my opponent, he's voted consistently against health care. You know, he voted against every phase of Medicaid expansion. He voted for it when it was proposed. He voted for it he voted against it when it got on the ballot. He even tried to kill it in the legislature after it was enacted. He voted against the funding the first time through, and he voted against the funding the second time through. And I might note, you know, in February or March of this year, when he voted against it the second time, we were in the midst of a pandemic. 70,000 Idahoans were relying on health care through Medicaid expansion, including 2,500 in our district, and he voted to pull the rug out from underneath them by eliminating the funding for the program. That's not the kind of leadership we need in Idaho.
Well, we have time for just a closing statement. Gary, thanks so much for talking with us. What thoughts would you like to leave voters with?
Well, my name's Gary. I'm running for the Idaho legislature. I'm passionate about education. I want to take the property tax burden off of the local taxpayer. I want to support local government, and I'm ready to serve you in Boise. My name is Gary Supiger. I'm a candidate for District 1, Position B. Please participate in this election. Go to idahovotes.gov. and order your absentee ballot. It's the only way you'll be able to participate in this election cycle. If you don't want to know more about me or my campaign, you can go to my website, Supiger4, that's F-O-R, Idaho, www.thebeatmusic.com. I hope I get the opportunity to serve you in Boise. I look forward to meeting with you and hearing from you and continuing to work, you know, to make Idaho great.
Well, thank you, Gary. If you've just tuned in, this is Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY, and today we're airing interviews with the Republican candidates for State Representative in District 1, who will be on the ballot for the May 19th primary election. We've just heard from candidates Gary Supiger. Now we talk with his opponent on the ballot, incumbent Representative Sage Dixon. Sage Dixon, Republican candidate for District 1, State Representative and incumbent, thank you for talking with us today.
Chris, I'm happy to be here. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Well, let's start out with an introduction for voters who may not be acquainted with you. Tell us about your background and the qualifications you feel help you in your job as a state representative.
Okay. Well, my background, my wife and I have been in the Sandpoint area for 20 years now. We've raised our six children up here. We had one more that we raised where we came from, a state from the southern area, or south of Sandpoint, I should say.
We won't take any guesses on where that was, so.
No, well, I think we have a lot of folks from that state to the south, so it's not as big an issue up here as some people make it. But anyway, we moved up here for a simpler lifestyle and to kind of be as self-sufficient as we can, and that's what we've done. We had a little hobby farm for many years, raising food and milking cows and chasing chickens and sheep around, and the children grew up doing FFA, and we were a part of that up in Boundary County, actually, because we live about halfway between Sandpoint and Bonner's Ferry. So we had some friends up there, and that's where we decided to do our 4-H. I was an electrical contractor for 15 years. Started my own business and was fairly successful at it. But when I was elected, it became hard to run the contracting business, and so now I am in the insurance world. I was a finance major in college, so I have a background with some financial knowledge there, and that seemed like a logical fit, and it afforded me some more time to do all the responsibilities that go along with being a representative. So, as you mentioned, I'm the incumbent. I've been the representative for 6 years. So I just finished up, well, at the end of my third term. Our term actually begins and ends in December, so I've got a few more months in this term, but this was my sixth session in the legislature. And it's something that I'm very thankful and honored to do in representing this district and both our northernmost counties and making sure that our voice is heard down in Boise. In my time there, I feel I've been a very effective legislator. I've kind of moved up in the ranks. I have the respect of my peers. I am now the chairman of the business committee. My peers in the House selected me to be the chairman or a part of the ethics committee, and then I was made chairman of the ethics committee as well. And then I'm also chairman of a federalism committee and a national state legislator organization. So I've got a lot of experience the respect of my peers and a voice within the legislature that I think is effective, and I'm thankful to be in that position. Being a small business owner, I understand the trials of small businesses. I've worked a lot for our businesses in this district, both small and large, and as well as agriculture and timber, and volunteering a lot of time with the Farm Bureau and working with schools and things like that. So I have a broad range of experience with what goes on in District 1, and I'm happy to continue to bring that down to Boise. That's what I'm seeking to do.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Well, what would you say are the most important issues for this coming race?
Well, I think there's a lot of talk about education, and I think there might be some misinformation to my position on education or actually my experience with education. So my first year in the House of Representatives, or my first term, I was on the Education Committee. And I'm a homeschool father. We've homeschooled all our children. So I have a perspective that's outside of the public school system, but I still know its importance. And I'll start off by saying I'm an advocate of school choice. I think that parents need to be given the ability to educate their children as they see fit, be that homeschool, public school, private schools, or whatever it is. I think it's important for education in general that parents be allowed to select where their children go. And I think the majority of people will still use the public system. So I know how important it is to our state and to the citizens of District 1. So I've learned everything I can about that in that in this, I mean, it's an ongoing experience, education, so pardon the pun, but it's been good to be a part of that and bring the Northern Voice down there as well. I've worked closely with all our districts and keeping them apprised of changes. I was on the Appropriations Committee for 2 years, so I was a part of the forming the budgets and the things that were occurring within education. I still stayed a part of that. I was a part of the Public School Funding Formula Committee for 3 years. So I'm understanding a lot of how these dollars go and what the challenges are for smaller rural districts, and I'm advocating for change there. I know it's hard to keep teachers because our borders and that people are paid more, especially to the west, and so we tend to take the new teachers and get their feet wet, and then they leave for more money right across the border. So I've worked on issues like that. So that's going to continue to be a topic, I think, but in this race, I think that's a large topic. Other things, we always have a transportation issue, although I think with the COVID-19 crisis, that's a bit on the back burner. But as far as our economy is concerned, we still need to have a robust transportation system and keeping our roads up. And thankfully, I've been on the Transportation Committee my whole time in the legislature, so I've been able to push, and I carried those budgets for 2 years. I have a great relationship with the State Transportation Department and been able to push for dollars to get up here so that we are able to move our goods. And when businesses come up here, that they have the infrastructure they need to get their product out of here, because that is something we're constrained by a little bit. So I think that seems to always be a topic. We don't quite have enough money. I know a lot of our locals are concerned about that. For the past 3 years, we've been wrangling and trying to get more money into transportation, and it's not an easy discussion to have. We came close this last session, but we have a ways to go on that. And this crisis that I spoke of earlier, that's really throwing everything into flux. And so the governor's already cut back on upcoming budgets. He cut back even when he was first elected and asked for some rescissions in the budgets. But now with the anticipated shortfall in revenue due to the slowdown of the economy, that I think is going to be a big topic coming into the next session. And that's probably being talked about, I'm sure. I know I'm discussing it a lot, so I'm sure my opponent's discussing it a lot, and it's become an issue in this race as well.
Okay, well, let's kind of start with that, with some of the questions we have here. Basically, the current situation we find ourselves in with a coronavirus response. Governor Little has suspended his stay-at-home order and kicked off a reopening of Idaho's economy in four stages. We've just entered stage one, which is going to go through May 15th, and it's allowing more businesses to open with some closures staying in place. And then we'll go into stage two so long as the virus caseload keeps declining. What do you think of the governor's plan? He's calling it Idaho Rebounds.
I think it's a comprehensive plan. I would have liked it personally, and I appreciate the approach he's taken with the knowledge, I mean, the information he has, and the tough position he's in. I can't imagine the decisions he's trying to make to keep Idaho safe. I think to put a blanket over the whole state and treat everybody the same does a disservice to certain parts of the state that aren't experiencing quite the difficulties with the virus that other parts of the state are. And that's been very harmful to us up here, and other rural areas anyway. The smaller businesses are so dependent, and resort areas, on getting that traffic in there. I wish he would have taken a little bit closer look on maybe how to allow us to be open up a little sooner, but that's hard to do. I mean, that's what I've got back from them when I've discussed this with his staff and been on phone calls with him, that it would be hard to parse this all out. It wasn't a very palatable idea to treat every district or every area of the state differently and to manage that. And of course, people are traveling, and so there's always the danger of people going to another area that does have a higher rate of infection and bringing it back here. So there's some wisdom in that, but I'm glad that things are finally easing up. I think people have been very frustrated, but at the same time understanding what needs to be done for our protection. And I can't wait for it to open up fully, and we still keep kind of pushing for that, but I don't think he's going to budge on that. So I'm glad we're here at the first stage, that businesses are able to open and start serving people, although it won't be quite as easy as we'd like it to, but we're headed in the right direction right now. I just wish we could have taken a look and maybe made it a little faster in certain areas.
Okay, well, one more question on the Idaho Rebounds program, because the governor just on Thursday announced that he's come up with a program to grant up to $300 million to businesses that are in distress and missed out on the first part of the federal programs. What do you think of that? Do you like that measure?
I do. I just saw that myself the other day, and I think that's a great thing to do, is we need that help. And that's what I've been hearing, again, from a lot of our local businesses, is they missed out on that first round from the federal government, that a lot of larger national businesses got that money, and it was scooped up pretty quick. So I think it's wise of him to do that, to take some of the dollars that the federal government's giving us and try and support our local businesses to help them stay open and keep going. So I'm thankful that we're doing that, and I hope it continues, because I mean, that's a lot of money, but there's a lot of businesses. And if we're getting something to help with our disaster end of the COVID crisis, then that's a great place to put it.
Okay. Well, I want to circle back on the education question. Education is the biggest piece of the state's annual budget, and yet Idaho still ranks among the lowest in the nation in per pupil expenditures by the state. What's evolved is that almost all the districts in the state are running supplemental levies to augment their budgets. And supplemental levies come from property taxes. I know that lawmakers from both parties started this last year's session saying they wanted to reduce property taxes, but no legislation advanced, and they created a committee to study this issue for another year and come back with more ideas in 2021. What's your feeling on the property tax question? Do you see ways to alleviate the burdens that have fallen upon the property owners, and also adequately fund education?
So I thought that was an easy question at first. And this last term, I served on the Revenue and Taxation Committee for the first time. And there are so many facets to property tax and property tax rates that it's not an easy thing to answer. There are some, I think, easy things that would help initially. And a lot of people point to what is called the Prop 13 issue that California has, where the rate that you have when you purchase your home, it remains at that property tax rate until the home is sold. I think that's valuable. That seems equitable to me. But we cannot do that with our Constitution. So it would take a constitutional amendment. So that kind of takes that off the table initially. Some of the things that we were addressing were, and this is sausage-making talk here, were just designed to bring some of those larger counties to the table and start negotiating. And so that's how we have this committee now, because there were things being proposed down in Boise that were coming from Ada County legislators that were very unpalatable to us up here, that our counties weren't having issues with as far as freezing budgets and trying to cap certain things that they can do. But our two counties in District 1 have been, for the most part, very responsible in how they've addressed this and not always taking the extra 3% that they can take and not going back into foregone taxes and things that the larger counties have done that cause a lot of ire. So there was a lot of concern from our cities and counties in what was proposed as a budget freeze, but that wasn't – so here's the sausage thing. I was guaranteed that wasn't going to go through, but we needed to push it forward in order to use it as a lever to bring those larger counties to the table, and that's politics in the way that works. So I think we're at the table now. We're going to have talks about this. It involves commercial properties, residential properties, agricultural properties, and how all those are taxed. So yes, I mean, that's a big answer for an ultimate answer of yes, we need to find ways to lower property taxes, or at the very least make it more equitable, so it's not just based upon what the budget of the county is doing in that sense, because as counties keep raising their budget, then property taxes are going to go up in commensurate measure. And then oftentimes people are pointing to counties, but it's a lot of those little smaller taxing districts as well that continue to raise the property tax that aren't always looked at. As far as the school levies go, being on that committee for 3 years, I'm hopeful that we can find what we think is the adequate level of funding for every child that's in a public school, or every child in the state for that matter, is what we tried to do. And education is changing so much with children being online at times and doing dual enrollment at times, or half homeschool, half in the brick and mortar building, that those dollars need to follow where the children are going, so that everybody is getting the dollars that they need for providing the service as well. That didn't go anywhere because it was such a large issue to get a hold of, and there were some things missed on that committee, admittedly. So they're taking a closer look, and of course this crisis throws everything into flux, but as far as what the actual numbers are, switching to an enrollment model rather than an average daily attendance model, and going forward from there, I don't know if we can go back to the way it was in 06 when it was an M&O levy right on your property tax, similar to, say, what your fire service is or something like that, because we moved away from that with the 1%. The 1% didn't ever really go to education, which was disappointing, I think, for a lot of people when we added the 1% sales tax.
Yes.
I think it'll be difficult to get back to where it is just on your property tax. A lot of, you know, there's a plus in that is that a lot of people don't see it because it's wrapped up in your mortgage, unless you own your property outright, and then you're seeing that when you have to pay your property tax bill. And it helps to avoid a lot of the conflict in a community when a school district is coming for a levy, because that inevitably creates conflict. But the plus side of our current system is that people have a say. If they value giving more money to education, then they can vote for those levies. Or if they don't think it's appropriate or think that it's too much, then they can vote against it, and that is their protection against a taxing district going too far in that sense. I think that's a good idea, but I also don't like the stress that's caused, and I know that districts are having a hard time, but I think we need to find out what really needs to be paid for, and then as a state, take care of that. And then if districts have more and their constituents in that school district want more, then I think that levy system is fine in that sense. But I have not heard of a very clean solution at this point, but I'm open to listening to problems. I mean, not problems, that problems, of course, but also solutions. To just say that the state is going to be able to throw a whole lot more money at it is it's a broad statement. It sounds good, but we have to keep our budget balanced, and there's a whole lot that we're responsible for in this state. Transportation and health and welfare and higher ed is another part of the education program, thing that wraps up our public parks, the DEQ, all these, a whole lot of different things that if we were to take more dollars and put it into education, we'd either have to raise taxes or something else is going to suffer at that point. And we have been consistently putting in over 5%. It's been $100 million for the first 5 years that I was in there, every year added to the education budget. That's the public education budget, just K-12. And then last year was $86 million, but that was still a 4.6% increase. So we have been increasing education funding. We added a new teacher career ladder, so they're in a better pay ladder right now. We've added dollars into early reading initiatives to try and make sure the children are reading at grade level by third grade, because that's a critical turning point that everybody agrees on, and doing things like that. So we've continually addressed that, and I think we continually will. But to just say that we need to put more dollars in and that's going to solve an issue, it's not an adequate statement. I mean, you get in there and you learn a whole lot more that it's not quite that easy. But I think we need to try. I like people to talk and to come to some conclusion together, and I'm hoping we can find something where everybody's comfortable, where the citizens are comfortable with what their portion is, and that the school districts are able to operate like they need to operate. But not, you know, just it's going to be a long road in doing that, but we're addressing it.
Okay. All right. One more tax question. This hopefully will be a shorter one. lawmakers have debated for years whether to remove Idaho's 6% sales tax on groceries. It came up again this year, but it was left unresolved. Are you a yay or a nay on taxing groceries?
I am a nay. However, that I've learned more than when I first went in as a nay, and there is a lot of merit. A lot of folks in the southern part of the state see that that is the only tax a lot of people pay. That's where a lot of the pushback comes in that, and there is also the reality of we will be losing out on a lot of out-of-state tax revenue that comes in, especially because we're such a tourism-heavy state and up here in the north. But I think that removing that puts us at a closer par to our neighboring states, and it seems like a moral issue is a strong word to say, but taxing food seems to be a good policy to avoid, or to remove that sales tax on groceries, I think would be wise. There's a lot of consideration, and it then becomes a large debate about what is food. Is Coke food? Is a cigarette count as food? Is it alcohol? And that will be a very long debate. There's federal programs that we can measure against as well, but still that adds a nuance to it. But another reason I'm a yay, though, is we started collecting sales tax for internet sales, and we put it into an account called the Taxpayer Relief Fund in order to offset our tax loss, our revenue loss from the sales tax on groceries. And that's coming along at a clip of about $60 million a year, and that's kind of right in the middle of where estimations are. If you want the sales tax on groceries to go away, those people usually say, well, it's only $35 million. If you want it to stay, you usually say we're going to be losing $100 million. So right in the middle there is this taxpayer relief fund, and it's averaging, this was the first year we collected it, but it's anticipated to be roughly $60 million. So that could offset our loss. If we were to remove that sales tax on groceries, that offsets our loss in our new collection of revenues from the taxpayer relief fund. So I'm still in favor of removing that sales tax on groceries, but I would want the taxpayer relief fund to function as we were told it would function when we passed that.
Okay, on to another issue here. On the initiative process, there was a push in the 2019 legislature to make the initiative process, the citizen initiative process, more restrictive in Idaho, and you helped advocate for that. It didn't come up in the 2020 legislature, but it may in the future. Will you pursue this in 2021?
I'm not anticipating on that. I still would say I think we need to make sure everybody in Idaho has a voice in the lawmaking process, and our current initiative process goes around that to simple majority, and I don't think that's ever the way we were intended to make law in this country, let alone our state. One thing that did pass this year was the requirement for the funding source and an amount of funding. I believe that passed. I know it passed the House, and we started to get a little busy there at the end, so I can't tell you definitively if it passed the Senate, but I'm pretty sure it did, because that was the most popular part of the bill that I was carrying in the House in 2019. So there's been a little bit more biting around the edges of that. Obviously, that bill that I carried did pass both the House and the Senate, but the governor saw fit to veto it, so it didn't go anywhere. But there still is somewhat of a look for some reform there from legislators, for the elected representatives of the people of Idaho, to reform that process, not to get rid of it altogether, but to make it a little more equitable to what it's addressing. But I'm not anticipating pushing that any further, Chris. Not myself personally. You know, there's other legislators that are doing that. There was something, I don't think we got to it in the House, but as far as the signature collection process and trying to make sure that is as responsible as we can make it as well. So we may see things like that coming up some more in the future, but I doubt that you would ever see something as large and comprehensive as what we had passed in 2019.
Okay. Well, we probably only have time to squeeze in another question here.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm talking a whole lot more than I anticipated.
That's okay. Hey, that's your job, man. So let's talk about Medicaid expansion funding. It came up in this last election, in the last session. Basically, in 2018, voters passed the Medicaid expansion, and it does leave a portion of that to be funded by the state. There were some bills in the past session to redirect some sales tax money towards the Medicaid expansion requirement. But I don't think that got resolved in the last session, so it's probably going to need to be addressed again in 2021. Am I correct on that? And you know, what's your position on the Medicaid expansion?
Yes, I believe you're correct, and I'm digging through something that I have right here to try and make sure that I am correct. But so I was not in favor of the expansion, but it passed through the legal means that we have available, and it passed, and therefore it's our responsibility to take care of that. And I've been pleasantly surprised that our numbers are low, lower than even anticipated, and because that was my largest concern. Every other state that expanded Medicaid had exponential growth of enrollment, and we have not seen that, so I'm thankful for that. But that was not a conversation I was deeply involved with, and at the most, I probably just voted for that on the floor. I'm trying to see here. Okay. Yeah, there was a bill. It was Senate Bill 1418 for the Division of Medicaid. I'm trying to remember those conversations, and I apologize. But,
so I guess the question would be, in the next session, there might be still a hole in the budget to be filled. Would you anticipate that?
So I think what a lot of our conversation was also is how or is it appropriate for us to get some dollars from what we were providing to the counties, because it was anticipated the counties would see a decrease in indigent fund usage and things that the counties were responsible for by expanding Medicaid, so that we thought it appropriate to take some of those dollars back to help fund it and to kind of spread that out a little bit, and maybe something with the hospitals as well, although I don't think that was moving forward quite as much as the counties were. But I'm sure it'll be an issue again. Yes, I mean, it's something that we need to take care of. And I know there's the chairman of the Health and Welfare Committee in the House is pretty avid about making sure that program is fully funded and in the best way possible and getting it out. So it will be a topic again. And it's going to be a harder one, though, Chris, I'll say, because we have more people coming onto the Medicaid rolls now due to the crisis, but then also our revenues are going to be way down due to the crisis. So a lot, as I said earlier, a lot of this conversation will be around funding, and I don't know. I just got sent the governor's economic outlook, and I haven't gone over it yet, but I don't know what they're anticipating as far as our loss to be and then going forward. And those are going to be tough conversations. I don't know if it'll be as bad as 08 and 09, where we had to cut back a lot, but it's definitely going to be a big part of the conversation, funding everything, let alone Medicaid and education.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the virus response that has been going on is going to create all kinds of new things for the legislators to deal with.
Right, yeah. Right.
And I hate to say it, Sage, but we're actually just about out of time. I want to give you an opportunity for a minute or two here, make a closing statement to the voters. Why should they vote for you? Or whatever you want to say, actually. Open mic.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris. And I do appreciate the platform that you afford us with these interviews. And I'm sorry we can't do it in person. It's always nice to be there with you and Susie. I've appreciated that opportunity over the years. I'm an experienced legislator at this point. I haven't been there long enough to kind of sour on everything and become jaded, but as I said earlier, I have the respect of leadership and my peers, and I've moved into a position where I'm able to give a loud voice to District 1, and people know me as a thoughtful, reasonable legislator that thinks deeply about issues and doesn't just immediately go with maybe what my first response is, but reasons through things, and that's how you reach consensus or are able to explain things and get bills passed, and we've been able to do a lot of good work for our district up here. I enjoy talking to everybody and listening to their issues and trying to find resolution for them or explaining why I won't, at least with my position on things, because we don't always agree. But I try and do my best to let everybody in District 1 know that I hear them and I understand what those issues are, and I try and get answers as best I can to what those issues are, and especially for the constituents. That's what gives me the greatest joy is a large word, but it's a sense of satisfaction when someone comes to me and we're able to get something done directly for a citizen in District 1, and been able to do that a number of times. So I hope to continue to represent this district. I feel I've lived up to what my platform says in creating strong families and a strong economy and trying to make the state stronger in general as well. And we have a large challenge in front of us the next few sessions, probably the next couple of years, and I think with my experience and my demeanor and the respect that I have down there, I'm the right person to continue in this position to continue to advocate for our district and keep the state going in the right direction.
Well, Sage Dixon, Republican incumbent, District 1, State Representative, Seat B, it's a long title. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
And that's our show for today. Again, another big reminder, you may only vote by absentee ballot in the primary election. You must file a request for your absentee ballot, either online or by mail, by May 19th. It must be returned by June 2nd. But don't wait to request your ballot, as it can take up to 2 weeks to receive it. Go request a ballot right now at bonnercountyid.gov or idahovotes.gov, or get details and information at sandpointonline.com. I'm Chris Bessler, and I've been the host today for this edition of Community Conversations here on 88.5 KRFY. I'll be back next Thursday at 8 a.m., so be sure to tune in then. Thank you for listening.